Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. And today we're going to be doing something a little bit different. We're going to be giving you some help with kid power. Yes, but it's in the sense of you as an adult being able to assist your sons. That's right, your nephews. Whatever we're going to be talking about that may be relating to the guys in the world, by golly, this is a man, Tim Hawk, who decided he was going to sit down and put together a 1 through 50 toolkit for young men. And I think that this is so important. In today's world, we have become so disassociated from interacting with kids in a way that was done before. And one of the biggest commentaries that is coming up more and more is the fact that young boys today really don't have very much in the way of male role models. I want to welcome our guest, Tim Hawk, and his book, 50 Rules for Sons. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Donna. I appreciate it.
Now, you're in the dynamic state of Texas, and I had to chuckle when I went through your book, because the rule number 24, which I just adored, I absolutely adored, it is, if you want to get a tattoo, go to your closet and pick out your favorite shirt. Wear it every day and every night for 2 years. If you're not tired of wearing it after 2 years, go get your tattoo. And I thought, oh, yes. Now, I know there's a lot of tattoo fans out there. But I, as a woman, I mean, and I know there are a lot of women that just think it's really cool. But the idea for me has just always been, I may change my mind. Why am I going to do something that's going to be permanently etched on my body? And I can remember when having a tattoo was not necessarily the best thing in the world because it created a persona around you that you may not want to live with. So that was one of your items. But I want to let my audience know about you, Tim. You are a lawyer. You've been involved with the law for more than 20 years. You've seen all kinds of situations. You've been a volunteer at the Assessment Center and Child Advocates of Tarrant County in Texas, and these are programs that assist abused children. And you're coming up with another book, 50 Rules for Daughters. That's the next phase, and I always like equality here and representation of thought. And I think that this book is so needed, and there's probably so many parents that would say, thank you, thank you, thank you, because we've become so detached. You decided to put this down, and of course, you have firsthand experience in being around kids. Why did you decide you were going to make 50 rules? What came up? What made you come up with that number?
Well, it didn't start out with that number. What happened is when my son graduated from high school a couple of years ago, my wife wanted me to write him a letter of congratulations. And so, like any dad would do, I sat down and started worrying about the things that I had forgotten to tell him, or maybe I just didn't impart correctly. So I decided to write down just a couple of life's rules as I had learned them. And I started off with 2 or 3, and then it kind of grew to 10, and then it got to 30, and then it got to 50, and I thought, I better stop, you know. So it really didn't start out as 50. It just ended up as 50.
Life is an amazing proposition when we think of how things evolve. And here it was, because of your son, you put together these items, and you decided then to put it in a book form. And you said that you really drew upon a lot of different people, including the women in your environment, in thinking these things through. And when I went through it, now you have to think that maybe because your son was older, this rule number one in your book was take stock of where you've been, but don't dwell on it. And that's a pretty powerful lesson. I think just about anybody can benefit from that. Why did you choose that?
Well, you know, that's interesting. I think a lot of times, of course, again, he was transitioning from high school to college or to post-high school. And I thought, you know, it's time for a break. And when you turn about 18 or 19, you have to reconcile with whatever past you may have, good, bad, indifferent. You have to, and it's a part of you, and that's fine, but you can't be obsessed with it. You can't be obsessed with trying to, quote-unquote, overcome it or wrestle with it or deal with it. It's part of who you are, and move on. And take everything that is part of you, even if it's bad, it can still be a force for good. So that was why I put that as number one.
There were a couple of other items here, and I'm just going to grab them out at random. You say, set goals and work like hell to accomplish them. Later, you'll realize the journey was far more enjoyable than the end result. I think that's one of the biggest lessons in life. The reality that bringing something together, making something work, the journey really is the story. And you were wanting him to not get too caught up in goals. Am I correct? Why? Their goals are important, but it's almost like there's a contradiction in that statement to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by that?
You're right. Goals are extremely important. But and of course, I've got the benefit of many, many years of setting goals and accomplishing some and falling short on others. But I would think that every time I look back on sort of a major life accomplishment, as it were, I always remember the time surrounding it, the time preceding it. When I first started, went out on my own from a law practice, I really look with fondness on the days when I worried about where my next case was going to come from and whether I was going to have enough to pay the kids, pay the light bill or get them some clothes to go back to school or things of that nature. And those times are to be treasured. They're not to be sort of looked upon in any with any disdain. So I wanted to make sure that he understood that even though it's bad right now or you think it's bad right now, these are the days you're going to look back on and remember fondly.
Yes, and it also develops resilience, I think. And that's something that we need to really impart to the younger generation. Your rule number four was offer those less fortunate a helping hand, even though someone may not appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
That is a big one. Do something because you feel it's the right thing to do. Being thoughtful, being kind, if that's what you feel you need to do. If someone doesn't like it, and they may even respond in a negative way or just totally ignore you,
yeah.
That is a big, big step in developing character.
No question. If you're doing it for anybody other than just yourself, then you're doing it for the wrong reasons. I tell a story in the back. Each of the stories has what I call a backstory. And
mm-hmm.
In this particular story, I talk about a time that I gathered up the kids and we went and served a Thanksgiving meal at the homeless shelter. And, you know, I don't know what I was expecting, except that I was expecting some sense of gratitude and whatnot. And it was a real lesson in humility for me because I thought, why are you here? If you're here because you want somebody to congratulate you because you decided to do a good act, man, you've got your priorities screwed up. And it's so true. Don't do charity. They don't want your charity. They want your empathy. They want you to feel for them in a sense that is not sympathetic necessarily. But it's because you want to do it out of, you know, for goodwill's sake or for whatever sake. But don't do it because you think that it's too condescending, it's too patronizing to go in and offer charitable works because you think you're such a good person. That's the worst reason to do so. And if that's why you're doing it, don't do it.
Mm-hmm. I liked your rule number 17. Don't be an ideologue or a demagogue. The world has plenty of those. Wow. We're, so often society wants to create this environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think people are people. And a lot of them are going to have clay feet. So, in fact, most of us do. And
mm-hmm.
being aware of that factor is very important. But this is something I think naturally that's encouraged. People want to be, I'll use a dramatic term, worshipped. And I want to say, excuse me? I'm sorry. You get gas like everybody else does.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way to keep things humble. This was a very important rule. Why did you want to get that across to your son?
Well, I think that so often now, people want to be so strident in their views, and they want to sort of synthesize, you know, various shades of gray into black and white. And this world is not black and white. It is so many million different colors of gray, red, white, whatever else. And I get frustrated when I watch anything. I mean, whether it's Fox News or MSNBC, you know, the right or the left,
mm-hmm.
I think most people operate in the gray. And I just don't think that it's smart or healthy to be a leader on something that you don't fully believe in and can support. I mean, the older I get, the less certain I am of anything.
Mm-hmm. That's the truth. You learn that you just don't know. Well, there's a lot mm-hmm. you may know, but you know so much less. I mean, mm-hmm. the more you know, the less you know. That old adage is very true.
It is. You know, Aristotle said, the only thing I know is that I know nothing.
Mm-hmm.
He's a pretty smart guy.
Mm-hmm. And that was a long time ago. And that is why conversation, discourse is important, being open to learning new things. And that's mm-hmm. one of your rules. In fact, that's Rule 25, that you told your son, don't worry about trying to impress people with your knowledge or experience when you're young. Just be interested, engaged, and eager to learn. Wow. Mm-hmm. I think that is so important. And I think that goes for any age. But, my goodness, we have so many young people coming out, and many times they're put into positions of responsibility. They don't have a clue about how to handle it. They've talked and studied and read things in books, but they have absolutely no practical application whatsoever. And it's like, boy, you can get knocked off your pedestal real fast.
Isn't that the truth?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think all about the other times that I've really advanced are when I've collaborated with others, you know, and when I've sought the advice and wise counsel of others. If you can really save yourself a great deal of heartache and probably money if you do that, if you seek out counsel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very true.
And, you know, it's interesting because the other rule that's sort of a companion rule to that is, my Rule 7, which says, be open to and unashamed of the possibility that you might be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's huge. That is huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You think that about the times you've been wrong?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think it probably would go around the globe a few times if I were to stand up and admit to my mistakes, which I usually do. But that is part of life. When you own up, when you fess up to the times that you have, putting it in blunt English, screwed up, and then you look at it and you have integrity with that and you're honest about that with other people, by golly, you're going to come out ahead. Because
mm-hmm.
one of the things that I have discovered, and I'm sure you have too, that if you don't have integrity with yourself, if you can't be honest with yourself, the likelihood of your being honest with anybody else is pretty remote.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No question.
One of the things that that I thought was humorous, it's your Rule 34. Keeping a toothbrush and toothpaste close at hand, a vigorous brushing before an important meeting is a confidence builder. And you have a picture. You have pictures going along with each of these quotes. And here's a guy looking in his rearview mirror brushing his teeth. And I just chuckled. I thought, my goodness, why in the world would you say that? I mean, that is something if people watch somebody brushing their teeth in their car and they're looking in the rearview mirror, they're like, what is going on here? Okay.
It's funny because I do that. I mean, I do that a lot. If I'm going to a meeting, I want to make sure that my impression is something other than my breath or the way I look.
Mm-hmm.
You know, impressions are, it's almost impossible to overcome a first impression. Studies say that people make up their minds about other people in 6 seconds or less.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
6 seconds.
Yes, and it's almost impossible to overcome that first impression. Almost
mm-hmm.
impossible. So.
Mm-hmm. I think that is such a significant statement. And that can even happen when you're talking to someone on a phone.
Yes.
Think about the people that do the telephone sales. Their voice automatically, believe it or not, will turn it turn your interest on or off. And it's a pretty tough positioning to be in.
Yes,
so
it is.
That is so important. And that is something that I think it's a good rule to pass along to a son. Rule 37 says, don't assume that an obvious question has already been asked. That is such a big one.
Mm-hmm.
I think asking questions, we need to be open to doing that. And if someone doesn't answer the question, we need to figure out or ask, why haven't you answered my question?
Yes.
And if they're hemming and hawing, you've got someone there that's not being honest with you. If someone says to you, I don't know the answer, you're way ahead of the game. But this is something, I think, assumptions. That's been a big lesson for me. And it's one I have to remind myself about consistently. Assumptions. Boy, the big A. Why did you choose that? What was your experience that made you aware that you need to pass that along to your son?
I have been in countless meetings with people where I have wanted to ask questions, and I have felt intimidated to do so because I didn't know enough about the subject matter, and I assumed, using your A word again, that everyone around me was learned on the subject while I was the only idiot in the room, and so I was embarrassed. I thought, well, I'm not going to ask that question. It seems like such an obvious question. I'm sure it's got an obvious answer. Well, over the years, I decided, you know what, maybe not. So as it became more frequent, of course, I'm a litigator, so I ask questions all the time. I started asking just the simplest questions in various meetings. And you would be shocked at the number of times we've left a meeting and people have whispered to me, gosh, I'm so glad you asked that question. I wanted to know the answer to that, too. Or the times, in the same vein, that I've asked a question and the people haven't known the answer. Like investments or my tax accountant or people at school, you know, my kids' school. I ask them, well, why are we doing this? Or what happened to X? Or what happened to Y? And they just either don't know the answer or they just never thought to ask it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no stupid question.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. Rule number 41 is don't get frustrated just because your immediate needs are not the priority of others. They seldom will be. That's a biggie. Because young people, and heck, I know adults that have the same kind of attitude. Let's address that, because I think that is very significant.
You know, we are the center of our universe. Everything that's ever happened to us has happened in front of us or maybe to the side of us or whatnot. So we create this false impression that the world revolves around us, right? I mean, my gosh, I've never experienced anything outside of my own center. So we're self-centered. And we think that everyone else has to cater to that self-centeredness. And it's funny and it's frustrating when they don't. I mean, my gosh, don't these people know that I'm in a hurry, so I need to get to the front of the checkout line, or can't this clerk act a little faster because, you know, just doesn't she know that I'm in line? I mean, it's this, we sort of project this intent on others if they don't wait on us immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to tell you, people don't care. If you're there and you're in a hurry, they don't. So why get frustrated over that? It's just going to lead to needless, frustration. It's a tough lesson learned because I'm a very impatient person. And I am the bearer of the double standard more often than I'd like to admit, but it doesn't help you, believe me.
I have found, I would categorize that as rudeness. And interestingly enough, I've observed in many situations, just with the holiday season here, the post office is just packed. And that's natural, that's normal. But I really observed the past few times in my local post office, people having to stand in line, and then I observed the clerk working, and she was so gracious, and she was so pleasant. She just is an amazing individual, as far as I'm concerned. And I noticed no one standing in line was fussing or complaining. Not a one. They weren't complaining. They were waiting, and some of them got a little edgy. You know, they're going from foot, you know, shuffling from foot to foot, but there was no rudeness at all. And really, the amount of time, and I watched the clock, it was like maybe 5 minutes. Now, I have seen people that have been very upset, and it's okay. And like I said, especially with this holiday season, I think this is a lesson that needs to be applied. A lot of people are working, they're under a lot of stress, and they end up with somebody that's really negative, and it wipes them out. It ruins their day.
It does, because they
are just standing there, and they're doing the best that they can, and they've got all kinds of things that are being tossed at them, either by their boss, et cetera, and with the people they're trying to serve. And the last thing they need is someone that's going to act like a child. They don't need that. They really don't.
Yeah. And how often have you ever gone to somebody who is a clerk or who you're frustrated with and told them, hey, have a good day, or you did a good job? You know, we always have these, we create these expectations in these people because, you know, if they don't meet our every whim, then all of a sudden they're against us or something. You know, it's just, it's crazy.
It really is. And it's something that I think, again, I love the information in your book, but I thought this is something that people need to remember. Courtesy, thoughtfulness is just as significant today as it has ever been. In fact, if not more, because too many times there are those that are standing in line that are texting or they're on their cell phone talking where everybody, including God, can know what's going on in their life. Who cares? Mm-hmm. But that is something that is part of the behavior that has evolved because of technology. So I think your point is very well taken. Now, this one, Rule 46, I'd say common sense dictates here, but common sense isn't so common. You say, wait at least 24 hours before sending a letter with the salutation, and you're sending this to your son. Dear Judge Dumbass, now, I would think anybody with 5 cents worth of consciousness would never do something like that, but I know that's not the case. What brought this to mind?
Well, that's a good story. I was a first-year lawyer, and I was always right. I was never wrong. Every case I handled, you know, was just the next case, and my clients were pristine and told the truth and whatnot. In any event, I was down at a hearing, and here I practiced law here in Fort Worth, and I was at a hearing, and the judge ruled against me. And he was a difficult judge. We didn't get along, and I thought his ruling was wrong. And really, to this day, I still think his ruling is wrong, but that doesn't matter. So, and I was really upset about it. So I went back to my office, and I dictated a letter back in the day when you dictate. And I gave it to my legal assistant, and I said, send this letter. And I said, Dear Judge Dumbass, in a letter. And so I said, send this. And she said, do you want me to send this? And I said, yes, send it. Well, that night I went home, and I had a rather fitful night of sleep. And I thought, you know, that was probably one of the stupider things you've ever done. So I got up early, I got to the office, my legal assistant got in, I said, oh, I really feel awful about that letter. I just don't know that I just should not have sent that. And she pulled it out of her top desk drawer, and she said, you mean this one?
Mm-hmm.
She had not sent it. So she had the foresight to save me from myself, thank God. Luckily, I've had a lot of people like that in my life.
Well, I think that really was an eye-opener for you. And I think it's great when you pass along that information to someone who's younger. I think it's so important for us to share our mistakes with people. They may not encounter the exact same circumstances, but what we're really trying to do is say, please be aware. I can't insulate you from life. You're going to make your own mistakes. But if what I've gone through in any way can assist you in avoiding some of these pits that you will find yourself falling into, some of them will be shallow and others will be so deep you wonder if you're ever going to get out of them, this is something you need to know. Take it or leave it, but you need to know this. And that's what your book, 50 Rules for Sons, is just, I think it's just invaluable. And you made a point, because in college, it is something that there are attitudes that are often promoted among the students. But you say, pay your fair share, don't be a moocher. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is so important. And we have too many young people that have this expectation that they have no responsibility for things. They're just in school. And I think that this is something that should be taught to young men. I mean, there's so many stories that we hear about gangs and all kinds of stuff. If the male role models were out there and holding these young men accountable and saying, you can't mooch off them. You're going to have to earn your way. You're going to need to earn respect. You don't get it just because you're Joe Blow from the middle of Okanagan, whatever, Mucky Muck, Tennessee. It doesn't make any difference. You have to earn respect. Don't be a moocher. Stand as an individual, work with people, and you bring up so many other wonderful points. When you put this together and you shared it with your son, what was his response?
It was mixed. He, I think he appreciated it, of course, and then he read it and he enjoyed it. And then, you know, but when he came home at semester break after his first semester, he said, you know, I really enjoyed your 50 rules. He said, when I would have some free time or I was stressed out or something, I'd go back and refer to it. And that was what it was intended for, you know, just sort of an occasional reference book. It's not really a lecture. I don't want it to be a lecture.
Mm-hmm.
It's more just, hey, you know, once in a while, pick it up and look at it and enjoy it. And then if you can use something out of it, use it. If not, maybe it's not the time in your life. You know, it's so much of rules that we learn are whether we're willing to learn them or sort of in a position to receive them and learn them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not, then maybe it's not time.
Mm-hmm. I think your statement, don't major in the minors, and that's rule number 48, the backstory that you have with it, and that's something that I think is really great. And for moms, if you have sons, if you have nephews, I think you will find this book invaluable. And anybody else. And dads, it gives you something to work with. And you can start with them as young as 5 years of age. I believe in that very, very strongly. But you talk about, especially with your son, and you were addressing this, when you're in college, there's party groups, there's all kinds of activities that literally can destroy a potential student's opportunity for moving forward and really excelling and doing the disciplines necessary. And you say engaging in petty pastimes leads to petty accomplishments. And that's a powerful statement to say to someone that's in college.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are so many opportunities when you're in college. Gosh, if you will just avail yourself of opportunities, you don't even have to have the best grades. You don't even have to be, you know, magna cum laude. You can go out there and volunteer or, you know, submit yourself for an internship position. Be available. If you do that, you'll set yourself apart. It's so funny. People wonder, well, how can I set myself apart? Show up and get engaged. Don't sit around and play video games. And I mean, there's a time and a place for things like that, you know, but don't be obsessed with those types of things. And don't be the guy that is always ready to party. I mean, if that's what you want your life to be, that's great. Go for it, you know. But if you want to accomplish something, start accomplishing something.
Mm-hmm. Developing the habits while you're there and the disciplines that are going to serve you well throughout your life.
Exactly.
And you're really not going to miss a lot if you aren't in the parties. You're going to be
nobody's
going to care.
Nobody's going to care, and nobody's going to remember them anyway.
That's right. Or if they do, it will not be with fond memories.
Yeah,
I'm
right.
Curious. I mean, I've known too many people, too many stories, and deep regrets that, well, affected them throughout their adult life until they were able to get past them. Tim,
sure.
Off your book, 50 Rules for Sons, is wonderful. I think anybody could benefit from reading it. And I think for young men, it's a very, very good handbook to utilize. Now, people can find out more about what you've got coming up. You've got 50 Rules for Daughters coming up pretty soon, too. They can go to timhoch.wordpress.com. And that's timhoch.wordpress.com. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Donna Siebel here. We're taking a break. We'll be coming back in just a moment with more to share. Don't go away.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny. that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hello, this is Donna Sebo. Welcome back. We're trying to reach my guest, Elliot Connie, and at the moment, we're not able to do that. So I'm opening up telephone lines, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And if we're able to reach my guest, then we will be bringing them online so that we can have a chat. Well, the holidays are just absolutely moving forward with such a speed. Sometimes I just shake my head and say, how did we get here so fast? And I know you've heard me say that before. But the holidays always bring a gift, and so many gifts. And I'm not talking about stuff underneath a tree. I'm talking about people, stories about people and how they deal with the holidays. And one of the stories that I came across was one about a woman by the name of Kathy Howard. And she lives in Georgia. And she had a Christmas that she shared her story
Your
about.
Guest is available.
Ah, well, I'll be sharing that with you in just a moment because our guest, Elliot Connie, is with us. Hello, Elliot.
Hello, how are you?
Well, I am absolutely magnificent. And we're going to be talking about your book, The Solution-Focused Marriage. And you are a person, now this is not a big book. This is a very easy read. And you have traveled through Europe, through the United States and Canada, working with various psychotherapists, telling them that they can work more effectively with couples.
Yes.
How is it that you evolved into a line of work where you have a couple sitting in front of you that are heading for divorce court, and they're saying, well, we think we should give it one more try? That may not be the most, that may not be the most exciting job to be in, because you're dealing with two people that really don't feel like they have any place to go. Why did you choose that profession?
Because I do find it exciting. Like, I enjoy it. When I first became a counselor, I had absolutely no idea that my career was going to guide me towards working with couples. And, in fact, I was just talking with one of my colleagues this morning about how so many counselors don't enjoy doing couples work for the reasons that you're highlighting.
Mm-hmm.
But I just view every relationship and every challenge in life as something that we can overcome if we took the proper steps to do so. And it just made me really enjoy not listening to couples in the beginning say how difficult their marriage is, but I'm addicted to at the end of the therapeutic process, listening to couples say that we're no longer heading towards divorce. We're actually, heading towards the bedroom.
Mm-hmm. And towards a relationship that's going to be an ongoing one. A healthy one.
Right, and towards each other and for the betterment of their kids and their whole worlds improve based on being able to resolve these issues. And they're not unresolvable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is something that when I started going through your book, you had a question. And it was something that had puzzled you since your childhood, which I found very interesting. What makes some couples successful and what other couples are unsuccessful?
Yes.
That is a very simple question to ask, but it's not necessarily all that simple to answer. Why was it that you were intrigued with this when you were a kid? What did you observe?
You know, I don't know. I observed my parents having horrific, horrible arguments very frequently that sometimes escalated to physical fights and verbal assaults. And I noticed that some of my closest friends, their parents did not do that. And at a very young age, I'm talking 8 or 9, I would wonder how come some families did that and other families did other things?
Mm-hmm.
And how come some families got divorced and other couples didn't? And it made me wonder some very basic questions that led to my current work, like what things could be done to cause people to change the habits within their relationship? Are these complex things that have to change, or are they simple things that have to change?
Mm-hmm.
And if they are simple things, how come some people don't change them and other people do? And at a very young age, I used to write in a diary about this stuff, actually.
Now, you encountered a professor when you were in college.
Yes.
That really stimulated something inside of you. Tell us that story. What happened with her?
Well, there are two professors. I met a professor when I was an undergrad, but the one you're probably referring to is the one I met in graduate school. You know, counseling is a very, for 100 years, we've been doing counseling, and we help people identify problems and remove problems from their lives. It's a very negative, painful process, and as a grad student, I couldn't wrap my mind around that. It didn't fit with the way I viewed people. I really, really thought there had to be a better, more simple way. And I met a professor who did some work that is known as solution-focused brief therapy, hence the name of my book, The Solution-Focused Marriage, where instead of trying to figure out what is wrong with people and how to fix it, we try to figure out what is right with people and how to use it more. And it really felt better to me, and it really resonated with me. And it's a completely different way of doing psychotherapeutic work, and it's a completely different way of going about resolving challenges in people's lives, and it totally changed. I was literally about to quit graduate school when I thought all I'm going to do is convince people how much of a problem life they have, and then I discovered that I could actually do the exact opposite, and it changed everything. It absolutely 180'd my career.
Mm-hmm. And it made you more effective in the way you worked with people. You have a quote with Bruce Lee here. Love is like a friendship caught on fire. In the beginning, a flame, very pretty, often hot and fierce, but still only light and flickering. As love grows older, our hearts mature, and our love becomes as coals, deep-burning and unclenchable. I think that part of what you express in your book, and you have a couple, Trish and Tony, they're getting ready to get married, and so you are the counselor that's working with them, and Trish is ready, but Tony's saying, I don't think so. He's getting what we call cold feet.
Yeah.
To discuss this with someone, to go in even as a couple when you're young, how many people do that? A lot of time, they're just not going to do it.
No, I would agree. I mean, a lot of times people just don't do that. But I would say that I think that's changing in recent years. I think people are realizing that relationships are a skill that has to be honed. You know, when I bought my latest car, the dealership gave me a leather case that housed 8 manuals on how to take care of my car. Well, relationships we need to learn how to be in marital relationships. And I think people are becoming more aware of that and are much more likely today to seek counsel on how to go about building successful, satisfactory relationships. Going all the way back to me as a young child asking how come some relationships made it and some relationships didn't, the simple answer is because some knew how to and some didn't. If you're from a family where divorce has occurred, you're more likely to get a divorce. And if you're from a family where both sets of your grandparents have been married 60 years and your parents are still married, you're more likely to have a modeled example of what a relationship looks like and thus behave in that same way. But unfortunately, upwards of 60% of people don't come from families where their parents are still married. So we have to learn how to be in 50-year relationships.
And people, and I think also having a healthy relationship. Yes, a healthy relationship. Lots of times people get married for the wrong reasons. And
well,
it's a very interesting challenge. And so it's something, if you have a relationship that isn't working, and there are some that you encounter that you really, by the time you're finished, you go, I think it'd be best, but you don't have to hate each other. But there are opportunities with people who really, really have a lot to work for, and they really could have a very good level of commitment in their life. And that's what your whole book is about, is the solutions to what can be done if they are open to that. Now, you had couples that just said, sorry, doc, not interested. I'm out of here.
Are you asking if I have couples like that?
Yes.
No. I think my job is, once they walk through the threshold of my door, my job is to be helpful enough that they are engaged in the process. If someone were to say, you know, I'm not interested, I'm out of here, I would view that as my failure, not theirs.
Mm-hmm. So you say in the book, because you have the subtitle of Five Simple Habits That Will Bring Out the Best in Your Relationship.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is take the credit for the honeymoon phase of your relationship. This happens with a lot of people. The quote-unquote romance goes out. Well, let's face it, daily life has to be lived. You're not going to be in a Hollywood movie that's just going to be playing La La Land all day long. Life has to be lived. This is something that many, many people don't like to deal with. They don't want to deal with that reality. They want to be in what I call the nirvana state. Like I say, Buddha even said, you have to get to the top of the mountain, but someday you're going to have to come down off the top of that mountain.
Right.
Communicating about progress. Address that.
Well, a lot of times when we experience a problem, we say things like, I'm upset with you, we need to talk. But how often do we do the exact opposite? Like, I'm very happy with what you've just done, or with the progressive steps we're taking towards our relationship goals, or our familial goals, or our professional goals, or whatever it may be. And I need to sit down and talk with you and tell you what you're doing that is causing me to be pleased. That is probably the most integral thing that we can do in any relationship, but it's one of the things we do the least frequently, because everybody knows, if I come home and my wife says, hey, we need to talk, I'm not immediately going to think that she's got good information to share with me,
mm-hmm.
or that she's got positively oriented questions for me. It's because we spend so much time analyzing negative data. So one of the habits that I outline in my book is that people need to talk about the positive aspect of what we're doing. We need to say, you're being a good husband, a good wife, a good whatever, and here are the things I'm noticing that cause me to still be pleased. And the thing is, we typically do those things in the beginning of a relationship. Like, we always compliment our partners. Oh, my gosh, I love dating you because you're so much different than my previous relationship, and you're so different than my last boyfriend, and you're so wonderful in these ways. But once we've been married for 10 years, we stop doing that. And we can't. We have to continue to exchange positive information about the conduct of each partner in the relationship if we want the relationship to continue to grow and prosper in a positive way.
And you have a chapter on how to function as a partnership, and that's a big one. I don't know that culturally that is something that is really encouraged, and that is true. It takes two to tango, and that is something that is a learned behavior. And depending on the culture that you come from, there may be variances in thoughts. But establishing the understanding of partnership is very, very important. Now, I know we're just about out of time, Elliot. People can go to your website, elliottspeaks.com. Elliot, E-L-L-I-O-T-T, speaks, ConnieInstitute.com. And also you have a website, theConnieInstitute.com. And
yeah.
You are affiliated about that. But both of those websites are available for people to explore. And I want to thank you for being my guest, Elliot.
No, thank you for having me. It was fun.
It was a delight. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Have you ever had a paranormal experience, such as seeing a ghost, having precognitive dreams, out-of-body experiences, or other happenings? If so, Donna would like to hear from you. She's putting together a book of 100 stories from people who would like to tell their story. If you'd like to submit yours, send an email to donna@delphiinternational.com. Again, send your story to donna@delphiinternational.com. Be sure to include your contact information as well. Thank you.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hello and welcome back. Donna Sebo here. Telephone lines are now open, 888-627-6008. Well, we have snow this morning in the Pacific Northwest. We didn't think we'd be getting it. The temps have been actually warm, but they dropped enough, and apparently the rain decided to turn into the white stuff, and it is so beautiful. But it's warming up so quickly, it's not going to last very long. So what we do here in the Seattle area is we observe it, enjoy it, drink it in, maybe take a bunch of photographs saying, woohoo, snow on the ground. And then before we know it, it's gone. It very seldom lasts very long here because we are pretty temperate in temperatures. But, oh, what a wonderful way to welcome in the holiday season. Everything looks so magical. And the people with their lights on their houses and the trees just sparkling in the windows. It is just incredibly magical. At least I think so. I wanted to share a story with you about a woman, Kathy Howard. And Christmas is a time when we love to get together with people. We really want to be able to enjoy our loved ones, our friends. And it's just not a plan at all to end up in an emergency room. Well, and that's what happened to Kathy Howard on a Christmas. They had planned to spend their time otherwise, but they were in a hospital's cardiac ICU. And this is in South Carolina. And here they are sitting and waiting because a member of their family was in the hospital. Actually, they had gone into ER about a day or so before, and she had made a five-hour drive from her home in Georgia to be with this family member in South Carolina. They had had a heart attack, needed surgery, and this was deeply, deeply important to her that she be with this member of this family. And she said, here I am, sitting in the ER. I'm not going to be able to celebrate Christmas in any way, shape, or form like I have in the past. No carols. Nobody's going to have a whole bunch of decorations up. She said, what I'm smelling instead of baked goods is the antiseptic odor in the hospital. And she said, I'm flipping through a magazine, and her mom was sitting there with her, keeping vigil relative to this family member that was so ill. And her mother said to her, see those two women over there? They're sisters. And Kathy said, And her mother said, yep. Their mom had an aneurysm, and I was chatting with them. Coming over and let's join them. So they went over and they were talking with these two women who, like them, are sitting in this ER. And they start having this conversation. They talked about their mother, whom they loved a great deal, how she was a world-class photographer and had traveled to so many different places. And one of the sisters happened to have a food stash with her, not a big one, but a little bit one. They had a bag of bagel chips, so they start chatting. And then Kathy said, okay, let's see what we can do. They started chatting, and she said, it was really interesting being in this place and watching people coming in. None of them wanted to be here. But there is a woman that walks in, and her mother, Kathy's mom, says, oh, see that lady that just came in? Her husband's a heart patient, too. They don't have a lot of friends, and their son lives nearby, but he's sick and he can't come. She's here all alone. Guess what? They start talking with her. Then there's a girl sitting there in sweatpants and a baggy sweatshirt. She wasn't more than 18 years of age. There was a big plastic garbage bag on the floor next to her. Kathy's mother observes and then tells Kathy. Her boyfriend was in a shooting. He's in for surgery right now. We're waiting to find out if he's going to pull through. All kinds of people, all kinds of circumstances and situations. Now, what's interesting about this, it could be depressing, but Kathy said, my mother had this wonderful attitude of being caring about each and every person that was in this ER waiting area. And she said, I realized we were all on the same boat. We were on the worry boat. We were waiting. We were hoping. We were praying for those that we loved, that they would be able to survive the experience, whatever it was. And it was a situation that Kathy said when she reflected on it, that it was one of the most significant Christmases that she'd ever spent. One, because of the fellowship that her mother demonstrated to her and the caring that her mother demonstrated to her and how important it was to realize that you're not the only person that's going through the challenges in life and that each and every person has their own story. Now, with Kathy and the family member that was so critically ill, within 2 weeks, they was able to go home. So a new year started with a lot of optimism and hope relative to this individual having come through a very difficult time. She said, being in an ICU is not really where you want to be on a holiday. And she said, however, I realized that that was one of the greatest gifts I'd ever received, to be able to share space with people, each of whom were sharing in their own challenges, their worries. And that together, we were able to get through a very difficult time, respecting and appreciating the challenges each and every one of us was experiencing. As you go about your holiday today, realize that there are those individuals that are going to have their challenges. Have a smile on your face. If you're feeling stressed, step outside, take a deep breath, and know and acknowledge that there's something greater than you are in this universe. And this is a holiday. But don't forget that sometimes courtesy, kindness, and thoughtfulness can bring you gifts that you would never expect, making for you, just like for Kathy, Christmas a very, very special event. This is Donna Sebo. I know we're going to be saying goodbye in just a moment. Remember always that you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Next week is holiday week. We're going to be having some guests on, but I need to let you know that the day before Christmas and Christmas Day itself, we will be having a pre-recorded programming so I can spend time with my family. But the 2 days after the Christmas holiday, well, we're going to have guests as well. So, and for the remaining part of the month. So make sure you check show information to know who's coming up and who's going to be with us. You're the master of your fate. You're the captain of your soul. God bless. Have a magnificent day or evening wherever you are on this fabulous planet of ours, knowing that you are a gift to the world because of who you are, and be open and receptive to the gifts that other people want to share with you. The gifts of the self, the spirit, action, however it shows itself. You deserve good things. Talk with you soon. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.